Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the November 9th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. The Washington Post has a policy of not publishing anonymous op-eds. In the spring of 2007, it made an exception and ran a piece by the owner of a small internet provider who 3 years earlier had refused to cooperate with the FBI when it had demanded that he provide them with information on one of his clients. The request was made in what is called a National Security Letter, a police state implement created by the Patriot Act, which prohibits those who receive them from telling anyone about it, not just the person whom the FBI is targeting, but members of the recipient's own family. On October 25th, a decade and 2 weeks after the Patriot Act was signed into law, the anonymous author penned another op-ed in the Post, but this time under his own name, Nicholas Merrill, in which he described, as much as he is allowed to by law, his experiences over the past 7 years. About 20 minutes past the hour or so, I'll be speaking with Nick Merrill, and you will hear how he has coped in the netherworld of America's encroaching police state. Well, by now, you're all aware of the slogan of the Occupy movement that began in Wall Street and has now spread not only across the country, including Ukiah, reflecting outrage against the disparity in incomes between the uber-rich and the rest of us that has widened to unprecedented proportions during the Bush-Obama era. It is, we are the 99%. And tonight at 6 p.m. at the meeting of the Ukiah Planning Commission on 300 Seminary Avenue, there will be a local version of the class war between the 99% and the 1% on display when the commission votes on the final environmental impact report that will go a long way in determining whether Walmart will be allowed to expand its current 109,000 square foot store in the Airport Boulevard complex by another 59,000 feet, and in addition to what it currently sells, become a 24/7 full-service grocery and liquor store. In a town that may have more supermarkets per capita than any other in the country, it should be obvious that the project, should it be approved, will have a devastating impact on the existing markets and the lives of their workers and their families, not to mention the economy of Ukiah and the county of Mendocino. Walmart, of course, is one of the giants of the 1%. It is not only the world's largest commercial retailer, it is number one on the list of the Fortune 500. Moreover, in its war for profits targeting the people of this county, it has been quietly assisted by another member of the 1%, CBRE, or C.B. Richard Ellis, the world's largest commercial real estate enterprise, whose consulting division provided the so-called expertise on what effect the Walmart expansion will have on quote-unquote, urban decay. It also turns out I discovered that CBRE is Walmart's real estate agent, boasting on its website as having sold 179 units for the Arkansas Leviathan. Now, one would think that would represent a conflict of interest, but no, I was mistaken. I naively forgot we are dealing in a world where 1% run the show, while most of the other 99% run for their lives. But the 1% needs its intermediaries to get over on the 99%. That's where Environmental Science Associates, or ESA, a nationwide operation that the Planning Commission brought in to prepare the EIR, comes into the picture. Nice sounding name, it even won some awards, but then there's the reality. It was ESA, with the approval of the Planning Commission, that brought in CBRE. In response to questions, ESA said there is no conflict of interest that, quote, CBRE is an international corporation with various business groups. The economists working on the DEIR, the Draft Environmental Impact Report, were part of CBRE Consulting, which is a distinct business group and not part of the commercial real estate business. Wrong, not true, or not totally true. CBRE Consulting is, or was, one of a number of divisions of CBRE worldwide, but by no means a standalone company that would make decisions that would negatively affect CBRE's bottom line. And they wouldn't have been able to work on the EIR without Walmart's prior approval. It also turns out that having CBRE evaluate its client Walmart's proposal is perfectly or imperfectly legal. And I guess that should be no surprise, given that the corporations, the 1%, write the laws for their flunkies in the legislatures to approve, but that our city planners were not informed about the connection in advance by ESA strikes me as clearly unethical. The law, it turns out, is even worse. According to the ESA, and I believe them here, CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, allows the applicant to prepare their own CEQA document for consideration by the lead agency. Therefore, prior involvement by an EIR preparer with the applicant does not disqualify that preparer. The applicant, it reassures us, does not have authority to direct work performed by CEQA consultants, and the city does not allow direct contact between the applicant and the subconsultants. The city does not allow it? No direct contact between Walmart and CBRE? That's good. How exactly can the city enforce that? By using the city's planning police? By calling Sheriff Allman? What do they take us for? Everything they can get away with. Quite aside from the stores that will be forced to close and the jobs lost and with it the workers' health benefits, you might contemplate the gargantuan traffic tie-ups that can be expected anywhere and everywhere near the Talmadge 101 interchange. If you don't find those prospects appealing, you might think of attending tonight's meeting of the Ukiah Planning Commission at 6 p.m., 300 Seminary Drive, and have your say about during the public comment period. Okay, what's currently making the headlines in Israel and occupying the stable of think tanks and columnists in Washington that it controls and causing concern in the White House and the Pentagon are Israel's escalating threats to launch an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities without even promising to let its Washington benefactors know in advance. While the Israeli press reports that Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Ehud Barak are trying to muster a majority in the cabinet in favor of military action against Iran, U.S. officials worry that Israel will not warn them before taking action against Iran, a senior U.S. military official said Friday. The unnamed official told CNN that although in the past U.S. officials thought they would receive warning from Israel before it took military action against Iran, quote, now it doesn't seem so ironclad. Then 3 days ago, Israel's Haaretz newspaper reported that during a visit to Israel last month, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta failed to get a clear commitment from Netanyahu and Barak that Israel would not take action against Iran without coordinating the operation with Washington. According to the paper, quote, the two Israeli leaders only answered Panetta's questions regarding Israel's attention toward Iran in a general manner. End quote. It hardly seems coincidental, writes former AIPAC staff member, AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, their lobby, former AIPAC staff member Doug Blumenfeld, quote, that in the past week, Israel has test fired a ballistic missile that can carry a nuclear warhead to any target in Iran, conducted joint exercises with the Italian Air Force on long range missions and aerial refueling, and held a large scale civil defense exercise simulating a missile attack on central Israel. At the same time, notes Blumenfeld, the U.S. and Israel announced plans for their largest and most significant ever joint military exercises, including simulating Israel's ballistic missile defense. End quote. A coincidence, or is the U.S. saying one thing and doing something else at the same time? It wouldn't be the first time. Iran's nuclear facilities are widely dispersed and the most essential deep underground. While President Obama, shortly after coming into office, provided Israel with bunker-busting bombs that are reportedly capable of destroying deep underground targets, few experts believe that such an attack could do more than set back Iran's program by a few years. Apart from the hawks, there is a wide consensus that any attack on Iran is likely to cause a far wider conflict and bring economic disruptions that will have disastrous repercussions on the already shaky global economy. If Israel attacks, Blumenfeld correctly notes, with or without America's backing or even knowledge, Washington will still be seen as either complicit or too weak to control its ally. Iranian officials have repeatedly warned that if attacked, they would not confine their retaliation to Israel, but will go after the many U.S. targets in the region, as well as its Arab allies, which would certainly include Saudi Arabia and its oil facilities. It would quickly move to block the Straits of Hormuz, which provides passage to more than a third of the world's supply of oil and gas. While the U.S. Fifth Fleet, based within easy striking distance on Bahrain, would be an easy target. The U.S., of course, would respond and respond heavily, and we would be in another major regional war, one with potentially far more devastating consequences than what we have witnessed in Afghanistan and Iraq combined. That's also somewhat, well, like Bloomfield sees it. He says, quote, "The American people are fed up with two Middle East wars. We already have and don't want another one. They are likely to be unforgiving even if they sympathize with Israel's motivation," end quote. Bloomfield, as I said, was a longtime AIPAC staffer and now writes a column for American Jewish newspapers. So you won't read that in the American mainstream media. His views, like those of another former AIPAC staff member, M.J. Rosenberg, do not represent AIPAC's position today, where one finds an eagerness to serve the interests of the Netanyahu regime, regardless of its cost to the United States. Unlike Bloomfield, who represents the realist wing of the lobby, Rosenberg has become one of its harshest critics. Here's Rosenberg writing this past week on Huffington Post. Quote, "Wasting no time after its success in getting the administration to oppose Palestinian statehood at the United Nations and still celebrating the UNESCO funding cutoff, AIPAC has returned to its number one priority, pushing for war with Iran. The Israelis have, of course, played their own part in the big show. In the last few weeks, it has been sending out signals that it is getting ready to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities and embroil the United States in its most calamitous Middle East war yet. But most observers, notes Rosenberg, do not believe an Israeli attack is imminent. If it was, would Israel telegraph it in advance? The point of the Israeli threats is to get the United States and the world community to increase pressure on Iran with the justification that, unless it does, Israel will attack. Naturally, the United States Congress, which gets its marching orders on Middle East policy from the lobby, which in turn gets its marching orders from Benjamin Netanyahu, is rushing to do what it's told," end quote. "If only Congress," and he adds, "if only Congress addressed joblessness at home with the same alacrity and enthusiasm." Those are my words. That's M.J. Rosenberg, a former AIPAC insider, confirming what I have been telling you for years. And he goes on, and here's where it gets serious. "According to the House Foreign Affairs Committee, hurriedly convened this week to consider a new crippling sanctions bill that seems less designed to deter an Iran nuclear weapon than to lay the groundwork for war. The clearest evidence that war is the intention of the bill's supporters," notes Rosenberg, "comes in Section 601. Excuse me. Which should be quoted in full. He says, "It's so incredible," he adds parenthetically, "that paraphrasing would invite the charge of distorting through selective quotation." It reads, quote, item C, restriction on contact. "No person employed with the United States government may contact in an official or unofficial capacity any person that, one, is an agent, instrumentality, or official of, is affiliated with, or is serving as a representative of the government of Iran, and, two, presents a threat to the United States or is affiliated with terrorist organizations," and then D, waiver. "The president may waive the requirements of subsection C if the president determines and so reports to the appropriate congressional committee 15 days prior to the exercise of waiver authority that failure to exercise such waiver authority would pose an unusual and extraordinary threat to the vital national security interests of the United States," end quote. What does this mean, asks Rosenberg. "It means," he writes, "that neither the president, the secretary of state, nor any U.S. diplomat or emissary may engage in negotiations or diplomacy with Iran of any kind unless the president convinces the, quote, appropriate congressional committees," end quote. Most significantly, the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which is an AIPAC fiefdom, "that not engaging with Iranian contacts would present," quote, "an unusual and extraordinary threat to the vital national security interests of the United States," end quote. To call this unprecedented is an understatement, writes Rosenberg. "At no time in our history Has the White House or State Department been restricted from dealing with representatives of a foreign state, even in wartime? End quote. Well, yesterday, UN weapons inspectors released new evidence that they say makes a credible case that Iran has carried out activities relevant to the development of a nuclear device, and that the project may still be underway. Fodder for the war drums that, incredibly, are once again beating. Finally, on the lighter side, if there is one, Israel denied on Sunday that a cyber attack was the reason several of its websites were taken down, including those of the Israeli Defense Forces, Mossad, Shin Bet Security Service, and other government ministries. An IDF spokesperson said there was most likely a malfunction with the servers. The government Facebook page posted a message saying, quote, due to a systematic malfunction of the servers, some of the government websites and services have not been accessible in the last few hours. This is a technical problem that is being handled by all relevant means, and all resources are being used to fix the problem. The network's crash came after the international cabal of hackers known as Anonymous threatened a cyber attack on the Israeli government computers in response to its interception of a Gaza-bound two-boat flotilla on Friday. And it looks, dear listeners, like they were true to their